Hello, I am Cody Ellingham, and this is the Transformation of Value podcast. In this episode, I talk with BitKiwi Dan, one of the other co-founders of the BitKiwi meetup events in New Zealand. We canvass a range of topics from government decision-making and how political neutrality works in the public sector, to what it might take to form a new Bitcoin political party in New Zealand. Dan is also a chartered accountant, and we discuss the opportunity around businesses wanting to hold Bitcoin on their balance sheet, integrating with legacy banks, and how the Bitcoin circular economy could develop. If you want to support the show, please consider leaving a review or boosting some sats via your favorite podcasting 2.0 platform. Otherwise, on to the show.
But yeah, no, it's weird being back in Shibuya. I mean, this used to be my, you know, my hometown, you know, and university and stuff. And it, I didn't think it could get any more busy or touristy than it was back then. But now it's absolutely just chocker full of people.
Yeah, I was surprised at how many out there on the streets are clearly tourists from all around the world.
Yeah, I think it's more and more people are realizing that their own countries are kind of fucked. And Japan has always been this interesting kind of alternative way of looking at sort of a reference for how far your own country has come, you know?
Yes, yeah.
Sort of like a barometer. And I remember just thinking when I was living here last time, you know, all of the political issues that New Zealand was facing and the West generally, that was sort of the Trump years. Mm. And it just was a non-event, you know, from New Zealand, from Japan. It just wasn't on my radar. But sort of coming back now, it's kind of weird having spent 3-4 years back in New Zealand and kind of just suddenly being away from that and just putting it on mute. It's been quite refreshing. How have you found it?
I thoroughly enjoy being over here, and I do my best to not really engage in what's going on in other countries while you are on holiday. I just sort of dedicate my screen time basically to Bitcoin over here. But other than that, I do enjoy, I don't know if I should feel bad or good about this, but I actually quite enjoy not understanding the language as well. I just in my own little world going about things.
Yeah, it's quite blissful. Like, I mean, you speak a little bit of, you know, undersell yourself, but like, I guess when it comes to the high level political machinations, you know, because there is stuff going on where, you know, there's corruption as always with the current government here. But I think even if you do speak Japanese and you do talk to people, it's not really a daily topic. I don't know. Do you sort of know what I mean? There's a difference, I think, in that daily engagement with the political realm in Japan. I mean, call it apathy, but people just don't give a shit, I don't think.
Well, there's a lot also going on in people's lives. There's a lot around them. And it's probably would feel a little bit more removed than, say, we do in New Zealand from the political sphere. And, you know, you watch their TV at night. I love Japanese TV. You know, even if they're just growing around Japan, looking at different foods and eating that and trying that, there's all sorts of, we get reality TV in New Zealand, and in Japan, it's actually, I really think that's a much better content just to be sitting there and watching. I really enjoy it.
Yeah, well, it also is quite affirmative for the culture. You know, I think, you know, it's, as you say, it's a lot of regional travel, a lot of regional food. You know, you could call it, if you were critical, you could call it mindless, but it reaffirms kind of localism. And I think probably the closest example we may have in New Zealand would be something like Country Calendar, which I remember when I was here as a student, you know, you get a bit homesick and you go and watch an old episode of Country Calendar, and it sort of reminds you of kind of the roots, the origin story of the country. And I know it's a bit of a national myth at this point, this kind of agricultural, you know, story, but you realize that's so divorced from just the shit happening in Wellington and this kind of culture war that is, I don't know, it was almost suffocating when I was there, and I had to get away from it, you know.
It's not limited to New Zealand either.
It's almost as if it's coordinated, you know. The invisible hand of the culture war is reaching out and touching all of these countries at the same time. I don't know. Where's it come from?
I think it's very much driven by media and political preferences of media personalities. Yeah? Those that may have a persuasion to the left get a lot more airtime, and those that maybe on the other side of the aisle get shouted down.
Yeah, it's like this kind of shouting match. I find it very unconstructive. There's not really, yeah, there's not really room for innovation in how you approach the problem. It's sort of just elevating the volume at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, I mean, that's New Zealand. And I think for both of us, having spent, you know, time together in Wellington, attending different BitKiwi events and kind of seeing the beast from the inside, now having this great distance, being on the other side of the world, it is refreshing, but it also gives pause for thought, because I sort of lament the idea that perhaps, you know, the New Zealand I once knew is gone, and it's not coming back. Or was it always gone?
I think New Zealand probably looks very different to what it did 30, 40 years ago. I think if we asked our parents and our grandparents, I'm sure that they would say things aren't what they once were.
What was the New Zealand you grew up in?
Well, I did grow up in the wider Wellington region. It was the time before technology. I'm starting to show my age here. So it was, yeah, a lot of it was self-directed play rather than, you know, you just jump on your bike and go to a park, kick a ball around. It was probably simpler. It probably wasn't as materialistic as kids are facing now. And with just a couple of channels on TV, no streaming services. Yeah, it was.
Yeah, do you think though, I mean, growing up, I guess nobody really pays attention to what's happening more broadly, politically, globally, but your impression that you had as a young person or as a child in New Zealand back then, like how do you think that's different now compared to what kids are facing just with the narrative, for lack of a better word?
I think kids are feeling much greater pressures now, and they probably couldn't necessarily define what that pressure is they're feeling, but there's a significant more amount of influence on people's lives. Some of us look through it, and for children growing up who are easily influenced, it can be quite telling. I think kids are facing, this probably is susceptible to much more mental health issues because of the complexities of what they're seeing and than what it was when I was growing up. And I don't just think that's because there's better diagnostics now to recognise it. I do think children are, I mean, I've got an 8-year-old that's talking about her weight at the moment, and she's got no weight issues whatsoever, but, you know, for some weird reason, it's quite a big topic for her.
Yeah. Well, I think one other thing I've thought about is, you know, I grew up sort of on the cusp of that, where we had obviously television and sort of the early internet, but it wasn't this kind of constant connectivity. And I think you sort of blink and then open your eyes again and you realize, you know, yeah, everyone is absolutely connected. And a great example of that was, we recently had a big earthquake in Western Japan, sort of around Kanazawa, where I was a couple of weeks ago, actually. And I saw it unfold on TV. I was at someone's house, and they had the TV on, and all of the channels went to the emergency broadcast system. But people were texting me about it from the other side of the world, and they had seen it on stuff.co.nz or whatever. And I thought, man, you guys give more of a shit about it than I do. You know, they're sort of plugged into this news cycle, and I mean, I appreciate the thoughts, and obviously I got friends in that out in Western Japan, but the ability to get that instant hit of information, I found quite, it's really quite surprising.
Yeah, I had people texting me about the plane accident at Haneda Airport before I even knew it had happened.
Yeah, and I think in a way, you know, I've often thought, and this is coming back to a sort of Socratic idea of like the relationship between the person, the individual, and the city. That you can characterize a citizen of New Zealand and the New Zealander, you know, there is a line between those two things. And in the same way, a Tokyo person and the city of Tokyo shares this kind of connection and the way of being. And I think in a way, New Zealand is a very naive, a very simple place. And I say that in the most loving way possible, but, you know, it's literally on the other side of the world. It's in the middle of the ocean. It's unable to really, it doesn't have structures for understanding political affairs. It really doesn't. And I think we've recently seen, say, in the last 10 to 15 years, an emergence of this kind of global, kind of exotic style of political thought, which, if you compare it with kind of the good old Jim Bolgers of the day, you know, born and bred, even, you know, the likes of Winston Peters, yeah, they're very much of the islands of New Zealand. Whereas I feel that this kind of new class of professionalism that's come into politics, it's like the introduction of the Norwegian rat to New Zealand. You know, it was just devastating, and the local population was unprepared for it. What are your thoughts on that?
To be honest, I don't even know what to say. That's quite a deep sort of like,
it's okay. I mean, you work with these people, though. I mean, how have you seen it from the inside, from your work in the public sector?
I mean, what you do see is the news of the day can quite quickly dominate the political thinking, for which suddenly positions are spawned quite quickly on, you know, so what once might have been well thought through and ideologically, what I'm basically trying to say is that the current issue of the day can really dominate the thinking that is taken forward, as opposed to sort of long, well thought out processes. You find yourself pivoting to what the latest headlines and the like are.
Sort of reactive.
Definitely.
I mean, how does that play out, though? Like, it seems, I mean, is it focus groups? Is it polling? Like, how does this tango of reactive politics actually come about, practically speaking?
I mean, it can come from, I mean, often it's sort of media stories that could spawn up through even just social media accounts. It is what is drawing the headlines of the day that it will often, as you can probably understand, get the most attention.
Because I think that's been a powerful realization for me, especially since the COVID era, is the outscaled influence of media, but particularly legacy media, and in particular just a handful of journalists, really, who can basically shift the narrative of the entire country. And I just saw something recently about Jessica Much Mackay moving to a position with ANZ as the comms person or something.
Yeah, head of government relations and ethics or something like that.
But this idea that there's this kind of cadre of anointed, what would you call it? Accredited journalists. And they set the scene, and then there's these kind of almost straw men Twitter accounts sometimes that are just anonymous, that are the ones that are getting retweeted, or they're the kind of the narrative that gets amplified. And I sometimes wonder how do they decide what gets the focus, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's not something I'd necessarily be too aware of. It'd be sort of thoughts as to what opposition members are saying that could drive.
So you think it is within the political realm, it's sort of some opposition and government sort of trying to vie for positionality on issues, or?
Yeah, along with essentially often their associates. You know, so these would be people that are loosely connected to political parties of the day.
What is your conception of the political party system? Because I think we, in common parlance, we talk about the Labour Party or the National Party, but I'm aware that when you actually learn about how it works, you've got these, what do you call it, the whips that sort of set policy and that sort of thing. It's really strange. It's almost pseudo-religious the way they do it. It's sort of like you have to toe the line. They have these kind of like closed-door meetings. You have to be a member. You've got to pay your tithe. It feels very centralized, very coveted. I don't know. How would you explain it?
Well, I think what is good for, say, New Zealanders versus maybe the Japanese is that anyone could get involved in New Zealand politics. It's not limited just to the uber wealthy, which is you can find in other countries. There certainly is an order for which things are done and how you ought to behave and to be seen. And I do feel that once, if you sort of step outside of that realm, you can find yourself punished one way or another, censored.
Yeah, it seems to me there is the sort of, there's limits on what's the acceptable discourse. And again, I think that's where my role as an independent is sort of challenged, because, you know, I know there's stories out there that ought to be investigated, you know, media stories, but given these gatekeepers, these centralized media entities, and there's only a handful of them, and I believe New Zealand is one of the worst in terms of its independent media landscape in the kind of developed world, there's really, you know, no way for me or for people like me to go and actually have conversations with that really push the envelope, say engaging with ministers, engaging with government corporations around topics that are important. And I think, you know, I've had a couple of situations where I've referred or I've emailed, you know, Guy on Espen or other people, and I've said, hey, there's this thing, and you know what I'm referring to, that I think you ought to investigate. I'm not able to do it on my own, and I've sort of not really heard much back. You know, I mean, he's obviously a very busy man, but I feel like, well, shit, that's kind of my only choice, is to, you know, reach out and email these people, because I certainly am not getting any traction. And I feel that, you know, there was the New York Times talks about democracy dies in the dark, and it sort of makes me feel like, you know, where is the discourse at in New Zealand? Because I think people are very unhappy with a lot of things, but they're not seeing those questions reflected in the media. And so there's this almost this kind of disconnect between what is said and what people are thinking.
Oh, I certainly think there could be elements of that. Where that may have been acknowledged is in the recent change in government. You know, it was really quite a landslide movement from centre left to centre right. Yeah, you know, some would say there's actually not much between them.
Yeah. I mean, well, I guess taking the topic to Bitcoin, though, because, I mean, obviously that's what we're really interested in, and rightly so, I think, looking at these political moves, I mean, I think an awareness of them is very important, but you can't get caught up in them. And I think that's, again, what really stood out to me is that, you know, when I emailed Guy on about the thing that, you know, what I'm talking about, you know, he said, well, I'm too busy looking at this lobbying issue that's going on right now. That was a couple of months ago. And I think, you know, that's such a scandalous kind of front page clickbaity thing to be going after, which is this lobbying issue within the New Zealand government, when there's actually a deeper systemic, that is a systemic issue, but I think there's deeper challenges we're facing right now around the monetary system and just the infrastructure deficit and all of that stuff, which seem to be only operating, the discourse is only operating at a very surface level. As sort of the more we talk about it, the more we don't build the things that we need to build. And I don't know, just contrasting that with my experience in Japan, where there's railways and tunnels and highways and everything is just incredible infrastructure-wise. It's like New Zealand's in the dark ages or something.
Some of that could be attributed to the three-year election cycles. I mean, if you're an aspiring politician, you sort of think big projects that could be completed in 30, 40 years' time. That actually doesn't often get you the votes of the day. And as a politician, you like cutting a ribbon. You like opening something. And big long-term infrastructure projects, I suppose the deficit in our infrastructure has got to the point where, how do you fix it?
Well, I saw someone say the other day, they were up in the far north, and it's not that you drive on the left of the road, you've got to drive on what's left of the road. And man, I know exactly what they're talking about, man, because, you know, you even leave our capital city and you take a shitty state highway through the middle of a town, and then there's a dairy on the side of the road, there's potholes, there's 50K zones, there's all of these things, and it's like, man, if we can't even get State Highway 1 right, how are we possibly going to build anything else? And I don't know, man, it's dawned on me that we've actually gone very much backwards in a lot of areas. and I say we as sort of the royal we of New Zealand, but as a New Zealander, and I think it's important to understand, you know, I do have a relation to the land and to the people, and you know, I don't want to see it regress, you know, because it's always a lot more painful to go back to the way things were than it was when you went from that to a new way of being. And so, you know, that this era of growth, you know, it's kind of a one-way function. That's really nice and comfortable when people get on board with it. But if you ever try to go backwards down that street, I think you see a lot of issues spawn in different ways. And I feel like maybe that's all in the mix of what we're seeing right now, perhaps.
Yeah, no, it's a well-made point. As far as a bit like the political context you're talking about, a lot of my thinking sort of just quick, whoopee.
I think it's a valid perspective, though, to, I guess, maybe we could get a little bit of sort of, as much as you're comfortable sharing, sort of your role and sort of what you've seen in terms of involvement with the government, because, you know, I'm adjunct to that, or I was, you know, as everyone knows, I walked past the Reserve Bank every day when I was living in Wellington, but I've never worked, you know, hand on heart. I've never worked for the government, you know. I've never been a beneficiary of transfer payments from the taxpayer. And I've not really gotten experience with what it's like in a ministry or in a department. But, I mean, what's your perspective, Dan, on how that works in New Zealand and sort of your experience here?
I mean, you've got public sector employees who, by and large, are very intelligent and work really hard at what they do, and you know, they serve ministers of the day, their policy agendas, and that can turn on a dime.
How would you describe the experience with the recent election, though? Like, how that you talk about turning on a dime? Like, what does that actually feel like to go through?
Well, I envisaged the outcome. You know, there's certain swathes of New Zealand that seemed shocked by that change, and then what has come since. I think what you're seeing at the moment is a movement from unwinding some of the policy positions of the previous government, and for the current governing parties, that's exactly what they campaigned on, and we're starting to see that. So that is hard for many public servants, because they can be quite passionate about what they had been working on, and then suddenly that project comes to a grinding halt, and you may even be involved in unwinding it, which is hard for some.
Do you think there's an ideology that goes into working for the government, perhaps at an entry or a mid-level, where you kind of have to drink the Kool-Aid, or do you think there is purely economic incentives that drive people to work for government?
I think it'd be a mix of both, really. I mean, some people are probably starting to sip on that Kool-Aid without even realising they're tasting it. And that happens over time. For some, it's quite hard for public servants to, you know, it has always been a challenge to put your personal political preferences aside in order to serve the government of the day. You know, Wellington's a reasonably left-leaning voting city.
But in terms of, I guess, your work, you're operating at a higher level. I don't how much you can describe about your work, but, you know, operating at a higher level, do you still feel that left-leaning bias in the high levels of the ministries?
Not so much. I don't visibly see anything that would have me think that it is present. I actually find that your senior public servants understand their role, and they understand it well, and so certainly are able to deliver on what has been requested by the government of the day. You really do need to be politically neutral, and you do need to understand your role in a way that doesn't jeopardise, you know, the government's intentions.
You talk about political neutrality. How does that work? Is there formal structures for that?
It's one of the five, it's in the Public Service Act legislation that it's a requirement to be politically neutral. There are mechanisms within agencies to protect people, to allow them to still have a personal preference. For example, if I work at health, and I...
Te whatu ora, you mean?
I'm not sure what it's called these days.
Sorry, continue.
You can still have, for example, if I worked at health, but then there was an education policy that I didn't agree with, I would be entitled to join a protest or sign a petition to express that in my personal capacity. Whereas if I was working at health and it was linked to my day-to-day work, that's where I would need to, if I felt strongly enough about it, remove myself from that work through either resigning, I suppose, or looking to be put on to another task. So you can exercise your rights as a citizen to voice your either pleasure or displeasure, but you've just got to be mindful that you don't do that where it's directly linked to your work, whereby people could feel that you've either been influenced or have an influence.
Do you think it's challenging, though, to sometimes unpick different issues? Because you talk about health and education, but when we're talking about something like monetary policy or government spending, generally speaking, it's kind of like, well, I'm against the whole thing, you know? And how does that affect the political neutrality?
Well, I think for the core public service, yeah, the Reserve Bank is quite removed from our day-to-day sort of interactions. I mean, you wouldn't often... It's very seldom that the major issues of the day actually are monetary policy. And I think that's because for a lot of the general population, it's quite complex and hard to understand, unless you really want to devote time to learning about it. And I mean, for many people, they've been raised that the current system is the ideal system, so you don't necessarily question that. And it's often, apart from interest rate movements, it's not really attracting too many viewers probably on these news sites.
Well, that's sort of, I think they're doing their best to try and put their head above the trench, but for the most part, you're right. I don't see them really with a media presence. I would argue that most New Zealanders are probably not even aware of the Reserve Bank or what it really does. You know, I think maybe they've heard of it, but in terms of its fundamental role in monetary policy, I think it might come as a surprise that they're actually pulling the levers, and that there was actually quite a lot of innovation that New Zealand brought to central banking that is kind of seen as a model around inflation targets and things. You know, one of our most famous exports is the, was it 1 to 3% target?
Yes.
Old Donald Brash, who I emailed him a couple of months ago. He did a podcast with what's his name? Rodney Hyde.
Okay.
Was it Dancing with the Stars?
Yes, his previous ACT leader.
Yeah. His
famous quote was, butter is a health food.
well, it is, and it's great for your health. But the idea, I messaged him, you know, I was quite despondent with the New Zealand situation, and he seems like a very educated, very articulate individual, but sort of really looking at the challenges that New Zealand was facing. And he sort of said, well, look, Cody, I think you'll find that New Zealand has, you know, rule of law. It's got abundant natural resources. Generally speaking, a can-do attitude. There's a lot of good nation-building materials there. You know, don't worry. You know, stay calm and carry on kind of a thing. And I sort of thought, you know, he's right in a way that there is sort of a lot of these raw materials. But at the same time, it's like bringing that together, and that sort of human action is almost the bit that's missing. And I think that the big example that sort of stood out to me recently, I was scrolling through LinkedIn, you know, which was my first mistake. But I saw someone mention, you know, building a bridge or a tunnel from the North Island to the South Island, and just straight out how impossible and how unfeasible it would be. And I had to really just sort of take a step back, and, you know, because I've literally been through tunnels and over bridges that are, you know, stretched further than that that gap of water here in Japan. And of course, it would be an engineering feat, but New Zealanders have done a lot of engineering feats in the past. But there's almost this lack of ambition. And I think Matthew Birchall talked about it when he said that we need to bring back that that spirit of building again, because what would it mean to have the ability to drive a truck across Cook Strait 24/7? you know, what would it mean to be able to have not have to rely on three fucking diesel ferries to get every fucking natural resource from our major island to our other major island? You know what I mean?
I do. I mean, it is quite a hard one to envisage given the chaotic nature of our Cook Strait services at the moment. That would
if it was Japan, they would have drilled a tunnel under Cook Strait in the 70s, and they would have four fucking high-speed railways in between, and they'd be carting millions of dollars of goods and people across there every day. And they do that between Hokkaido and Honshu. They do it in a bunch of different places. And I mean, obviously, there's a larger population, different demographics, but it's also a geologically active area. It's almost like the attitude isn't, the guts aren't there to build, which I find a bit offensive personally. It's like, well, fuck you. You know, I know enough people in our Bitcoin group that we could probably get some capital together and build the bridge. But you just don't see that anymore. And instead, it's, again, it's the slight sophistry of the end game of politics almost. Sorry, that's a bit of a rant.
No.
How did we get onto this, though? Talking about interest rates, government, sort of, was it political neutrality? Waka Kotahi, you know, building the road and fixing the potholes. I mean, how did they come out? And, you know, someone working in that area, in that ministry, is it a ministry? Ministry of Transport? Yeah, NZTA.
Yes, New Zealand Transport Agency, I believe.
Yeah. So it's an agency. What is the difference between agency?
It's a Crown entity, I believe, so it's not a core government department. It would be monitored by the Ministry of Transport, so it is essentially probably the delivery arm.
I see.
Of New Zealand.
What if they just snipped that little umbilical cord and made it into a
Ministry for Works?
Oh, man. Yeah. So I wonder how that affects the ability for change to come from within. And I think this is kind of where I'm wanting to get at with this discussion is, you know, there's this idea in communism of the long march towards the institutions, I think. Which is the idea that, you know, you slowly colonize government, academia, you know, ministries with people who are sort of open to a certain ideology, and they sort of slowly grandfather into different positions of power, and then they can affect, kind of subtly sort of wave their hands and sort of affect the direction that things are going. And it takes decades, I think, but it's almost like the old Labour of Helen Clark, you know, the graduates of that era are now entering sort of mid-career within New Zealand government. And so we still haven't quite washed out the red and the green stains. No matter how much you sort of say that you're politically neutral, I feel like there's always going to be these kind of people looking to sort of manoeuvre. You know, they're not purely servant leaders, are they? I don't know. What do you think?
Well, it's an interesting antidote that you shared. I was thinking as you were going through that, I was thinking really, while I could envisage that over a few decades, I do think that to affect change that you would like to see, you do really need to achieve that through the politics, through actually getting some people together and trying to get over that 5% threshold. You've got this interesting scenario in New Zealand where these parties that get between 5-10% actually yield quite a lot of power in regards to the outcome of an election. The MMP sort of system, certainly I think it should be quite inspiring to people interested in politics, as you wouldn't sit there and go, well, we'd need to be the main party of New Zealand. You can actually achieve a hell of a lot through a minority party and a coalition government.
Yeah. I wonder if that's an opportunity, because we're one of the few countries that really has that. And I think it was a bit challenging with this most recent election. I think there was a couple of parties that, I mean, the one that comes to mind is TOP, you know, the Opportunities Party, which in particular didn't quite meet that threshold. And I think their approach was to focus on one Christchurch electorate, I think it was.
Yeah, Elam, I think they were contesting.
And I think that was a bit of a flop, but in terms of, say, Bitcoin,
yes,
and this is where we're getting a bit
sacrilegious against the idea of the political and the Bitcoin coming together. But I mean, what is that? 5% is that? What's New Zealand at? 5 million or 6 million now?
I think about 5 million, and you'd probably
5% of the voting population.
Yeah, it'd be those vote of the vote. And
what was the turnout this time around?
I have not seen that yet. I mean, it certainly will be published somewhere.
We'll call it 3 million.
Yes,
adults maybe.
They've actually seen voter participation decline election on election over the last few election rounds. So I'd be.
What does that mean for 5%? So 5% of, I mean, ambitiously a 3 million voter turnout. So 10% would be 300,000. So
150,000.
Are there 150,000 Bitcoiners in New Zealand?
Not yet. I don't believe.
Will there be?
Well, if I reckon global adoption at the moment or holding is around 1%, you probably need to, once that sort of got up to 5 or 6% globally, you might find there are enough, because I think a lot of Bitcoiners probably are single-issue voters.
How would you characterize, I guess, from your position, the relationship that executives, higher-level management within the ministries and government have towards Bitcoin?
I don't think that would be any different from the general population. For many people, it is just a deep unknown. You know, we're lucky in New Zealand that we don't have any issues transacting. And so for a lot of people, there's no need for any change. It's worked for me. I've got multiple houses type of thing. And life's good. Yeah, it's probably for the people in the countries, war-torn countries, countries with high corruption and the like. It will be in those areas where there'll be greater earlier interest for many people in the countries we've grown up in. Life's good.
Yeah, I think that's one of the, again, sort of pessimistic sort of takes that I would have, is that hope would lie with, you know, younger people. You know, I think there's a certain class of, you know, the prerogative of boomer, I think, applies here. But, you know, the homeowners effectively within New Zealand, I think, would be very much against, but for the most part, any policy that somehow affects the value of their home. And then there's a whole cadre of, you know, freshly minted left-leaning kind of greeny types who have gone through the education system over the last few years. And they are very much, I think, out of the box, I feel like there's a lot of negative opinions about Bitcoin that's just been imprinted. And so you've got, you know, the people who really ought to be voting for change are still kind of LARPing on this kind of socialist idea that's coming around. Oh, it's coming to an end, right? We're sort of entering a new era. But that, I don't know. How do you make those two things meet? Because, you know, a generation of voters who, young emerging, you know, citizens who are passionate about Bitcoin, I mean, that could make a huge difference. But I just don't see that cohort in New Zealand anywhere.
And you probably find that cohort doesn't exist in any mass, actually, in any country at the moment. You know, sometimes when you sit and go, gee, my stack's not big enough, you sort of sit back and reflect and look at how many people have addresses, Bitcoin addresses, and like, you realize actually it's just a symptom of us still being early. It will come.
I mean, you're right. I think it will come, but how does that interface with the legacy political system? I mean, I'm interested in exploring this because, you know, will it just be a simple, you know, but just becomes one of the issues of the day that these politicians are then reacting to, perhaps?
I mean, it could well be. It'll take a huge amount of more knowledge to be gained by a larger number of people for it really to take hold in any meaningful way. But at the point where an aspiring politician or an existing politician sees it as being an issue worthy of discussion, it'll be on the radar.
Have you seen, in your capacity, any conversations internally within government that have Bitcoin tones or Bitcoin explicitly mentioned?
No, I haven't. But I have you know, looking at the IRD's guidance on, I'll use the dirty term, cryptocurrency, and what they talk about the mining, there's certainly, what I'd like to say is whoever's produced this, and it was produced some time ago, was clearly quite knowledgeable in what it was all about. And I actually think it's quite impressive guidance.
Do you think the overall, looking at the policies and just sort of the framework in New Zealand right now, I mean, how would you describe it? How, you know, what do you see in terms of the landscape legally and just and that sort of thing?
Well, I feel the settings at the moment are quite conducive to Bitcoin innovation for those that are willing. I wouldn't feel that you see any resistance that makes you think, should I take my talents elsewhere where they'd be greater appreciated or at least more welcomed. I do think New Zealand, as it currently stands, is certainly open to good ideas, and for those that are building on Bitcoin, I think you could do that confidently in New Zealand without fear of reprisal or cancellation or anything like that. I do think it is ripe for it. It's just we are early. And
what about the perennial issue of bank account access, though, for fiat rails?
That is a tricky one. That's one we've actually had difficulties with myself. I actually think that that's sort of banking policy of these banks as opposed to sort of any directive. I know at times it'll be down to anti-money laundering laws that might make it difficult for them. I think banks have just taken this position and clearly they've got a vested interest.
Is there any precedence for that? My layman approach here would be, well, shit, isn't that discriminatory to be turning off bank account access? And obviously they're a private bank, they can do that. But I mean, I don't know, is there any mechanism? Is it Commerce Commission? Is it some way of sort of addressing this issue of bank account access for Bitcoin businesses?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, you could put that question to the banking ombudsman.
Do you have his contact details?
They will certainly be online with Google. Yeah. And put that question to the banking ombudsman. What I imagine would be said is that their risk assessment shows that risk is too great and engaging in Bitcoin-related activity.
I wonder if there's been some bad eggs in the past that have led them to sort of have their fingers burned. You know, Cryptopia comes to mind, but I don't know. I wasn't around at that point, but I wonder, did you know if Cryptopia had New Zealand bank accounts?
I'm not sure, sorry. Yeah. And I do think banks are probably in a bit of a confused state between a genuine Bitcoin innovative growing company versus I read a horrible story about, basically, I think it was in Myanmar, how they've got dormitories of people that are running crypto scams. And so I think a lot of the offshore scams, which is certainly not an issue with Bitcoin in itself, that's not the scam. It's these bad actors out there. So I think at this stage in the commercial cycle for banks, it's easier just to say no.
Do you think there could be an opportunity, though, with, I mean, New Zealand is in an interesting kind of almost neo-colonial position where we don't have any major banks that are actually New Zealand owned. I wonder how much directive is taken from Australia, and I wonder if there's opportunities for some of these smaller community banks or like, what do you call them?
Is that the TSP, cooperative banks? Yes.
Do you know if there could be something in that space that is promising?
I'm not aware of anything, but they would certainly, I would feel, have more license to make their own decisions as to what they'd like to pursue.
Because I know certainly just from friends and family who have maybe had issues with, you know, your Westpacs and your ANZs, going to some of the community trust banks, community trust, you don't call them banks, do you? It's just a community trust. Sometimes they're able to be a bit more lenient with lines of credit or mortgages or things like that. And so I wonder if that's a potential avenue that is open for exploration as, a solid Bitcoin business building a relationship with a New Zealand entity like that.
I imagine game theory will come into play. And for some of these smaller banks, when they see the commercial opportunity there, they probably will be more open to pursuing that. Then the big ones will come flying in after to also capture.
I mean, what is the opportunity? I guess you're asking for bank account access. Are you?
It's to give someone a start to actually be able to build a Bitcoin related business with the ease on fair playing ground to any other business that just wants to get up and have a go.
Because I wonder if the opportunity is a bit more closer to the financial entity itself, where, you know, it's not just give me a bank account, but it's more like, well, look, you know, there's this growing number of people who want to use Bitcoin. We need, firstly, access, but more than that, actually the ability to facilitate transactions, and actually almost like a collaborative approach. So the way that a lot of banks are the conduit for, you know, Visa cards and ATMs and point of sale units and things. I don't know. I just wonder if there's something in there as a new almost business model. Somehow the banks kind of can collaborate. And I mean, that's a controversial opinion, I guess, because it's sort of centralizing. But I mean, what would be the first New Zealand financial entity to start using Lightning, for example? I mean, what would that mean for custodial Bitcoin within New Zealand and not relying on some overseas entity, for example?
I mean, it's certainly wonderful food for thought. I mean, I think when we talk about bank account access, I think for a lot of us, we haven't got beyond the bank account access because we can't even get the most simplest sort of service from the bank.
Oh.
And so I think, once that becomes available, I think you'd have Bitcoiners falling over each other to try and work collaboratively with, I suppose, any entity that would be willing to facilitate the transactions.
So I guess continuing that line of thought, I wonder, I guess the concern that I have is, you know, you've got the likes of Binance coming in as this kind of registered financial services provider. And I keep mentioning it on their LinkedIn page, you know, asking when are they going to rebrand and change their name so they're not associated with the money laundering of Binance USA. And I have yet to receive a response. However, somewhere deep down, I feel more comfortable with someone like your TSBs or your cooperative banks being involved in something as important as Bitcoin than I do with someone like Binance and their gung-ho approach to, you know, shilling shit coins, you know?
Yes. But I think that would come at a time when there's the commercial gains there for an entity to do that. I think at the moment, sitting around the board table looking, if you're exploring that, you'd say, well, it's a great idea, but it's probably not at this stage. With their risk-reward sort of cost-benefit analysis would have them probably pursuing other things at the moment.
I wonder if there's an opportunity. I mean, sort of, I was listening to a great podcast with, was it Prince Philip of Serbia and Samson Mao talking about some of their A-team missions around the world to kind of orange pill different governments and things. And it's actually quite inspiring. It's really cool. It'll be a movie one day, I think. But I think looking at some of these financial entities, I mean, what would it take for them to just have some Bitcoin on the balance sheet? I mean, how does that work? And I guess from an accounting perspective?
Well, the recent changes to the accounting framework for at least for Bitcoin in the US lately is very promising. I mean, I think prior to that, you needed to value that the Bitcoin that you had on your balance sheet at the lowest it's been since you held it. So, you know, if you bought it at 15, it dropped to 15, and it was back up at 50 at reporting date, you were having to record that at its impaired value of 15. Where moving forward, I think towards the end of this year, and it can be adopted now, an entity records at its true value at that time.
Mark to market.
Yeah, so that's significantly more appealing to have on your balance sheet. Because, I mean, I imagine most companies would have looked at the volatility. There would have been, you know, they've seen bear markets, and to have it on your balance sheet was quite brave. You know, MicroStrategy has been very brave in doing that. And you see at the moment, you know, they're actually doing, in hindsight, it's been a great decision. You'll see more doing it going forward. But for many corporate entities, that just wouldn't have been a good treasury asset to be having on your balance sheet for reporting purposes, you know, due to the obligations you've got to the shareholders and the like.
And you're also a chartered accountant, aren't you?
Correct.
Yeah. I mean, in your experience, how have you seen companies or institutions approach, say, these riskier assets as part of the broader mix of their the assets they have on their balance sheet? I mean, is it common practice to have kind of more volatile assets sitting around on the balance sheet?
No, I mean, you generally go for the most conservative, safest assets that you get your hands on. Would that be treasury assets, cash? There's the speculative as you get would be owning shares in other companies, having them as part of your balance sheet.
Because I know certainly just in my dealings with different people, you know, you still see a lot of, you know, small, medium organisations in New Zealand that are sitting on cash.
Yes.
You know, and obviously, you know, there's an interest rate associated with that. But, I mean, is there directive or desire to outperform inflation in those situations? Or, like, how are the people approaching that?
Well, I think for a lot of businesses, inflation aside, they're actually quite comfortable having cash on their balance sheet to ride them through the more turbulent times. I think you'll find, if you have asked the average person on the street, say, how detrimental is inflation to your life, to society? I mean, I think you get some quite limited understanding. So I think, you know, having cash on the, you know, cash is king is certainly quite a common statement that's used, particularly in tough times. So I think either cash or something that can be easily converted to cash is certainly still the preferred asset.
Yeah, so liquidity, I think. Yeah. I mean, my high-level take on New Zealand is we have a predominance of small and medium businesses, a lot of owner-operators and stuff. And in those situations, cash flow and basically, you know, the piggy bank or the kitty is sort of, you know, paramount just to pay the bills. And I think as things get tougher, maybe we see those time horizons shrink where, you know, there's no assets, it's just cash to keep things afloat, perhaps.
Yes, no, absolutely. It'll be some time. I mean, you're probably at best you'll get is the odd small business allocating a small, or probably at some point accepting Bitcoin and just deciding to hold it as opposed to introducing it on the balance sheet through purchasing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd love to see an environment whereby there's been a lot of chatter on X lately about these institutions gobbling up all the Bitcoin out there, given it's a limited supply. It'd be great where you've got maybe your butcher, your local grocer accepting Bitcoin, for which they then hold. So it's only a small take of their weekly sales, but yeah, they're confident enough that, yes, I'll accept that and I'll just hodl it. I think that's where we'd like to get to.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of circular economy medium of exchange, you know. I think though still we're looking at it as a store of value, you know, discussion. I mean, what would it take in your experience as a chartered accountant as well? Like, I mean, is there directive from, I mean, is what is the organization that chartered accountants are affiliated with in New Zealand? Is there an organization?
It's Chartered Accountants Australia and New Zealand now. It was New Zealand Institute of Chartered Accountants, but they've merged with Australia.
I see. So would that indicate it's effectively a singular approach to best practice between Australia and New Zealand? Like, could you, if you're qualified in New Zealand, you could operate in Australia?
You can operate in Australia, yes. Yeah.
And I wonder, do you know if you've seen anything come out of that institute, that organization, in terms of Bitcoin directive or advice?
No, not that I haven't certainly seen anything. You do occasionally, you'll see the odd article in the magazines, but that will be cryptocurrency. There isn't, basically, the door is open to get it stuck into it as much as you would like as a business. It's just, there's the lack of knowledge and understanding out there to know what does that mean.
Because I think, I mean, maybe that's an opportunity, just, you know, spitballing here, but it, I mean, one of the challenges is that you can't easily purchase Bitcoin through a business bank account. As far as I'm aware, you do. So the exchanges I've seen, you know, it's sort of, you have to be an individual.
Yes.
But that aside, I mean, get off zero for individuals is one thing, but get off zero for businesses is another thing. And I wonder if that's a movement that could be, you know, is that a segment that could be targeted as almost as a product, you know? So helping businesses buy their first Bitcoin, perhaps.
No, I think it'd be a combination of helping business understand why it would be useful to hold Bitcoin on the balance sheet. And once they've got that understanding, helping them to go about acquiring it to put on their balance sheet.
When you talk about businesses having cash in New Zealand, I mean, is that like checking account cash? Is the term deposits? Like, what have you seen?
It would be a mix of both. They would essentially put in term deposit what you didn't feel you were going to need over a certain time period, and then you'd have your checking account for your day-to-day
operations. What would be a common, like a 90 day term deposit or longer periods? What have you seen?
It really does depend on the needs of that business. It's a mix from 90 days right through to much longer time frames.
Because I wonder if you could see, I mean, obviously Bitcoin performs over the longer term, you know, and sort of smooths out short-term volatility. I wonder if you could see a product where maybe some of the custodial aspects are facilitated. I mean, it is a lot of kind of do your own research at this point in time, but I think making that a little bit more point and click, perhaps some degree of custodial relations where, you know, it's sort of looked after for you, maybe two of three, multi-sig or whatever it needs to be. But, you know, could that be a product so that there isn't sort of a massive learning curve? It's sort of more like, well, you know, I saw the ad and I'm going to sign up. I'm reluctant, though, at what the business model would be, because, you know, you still sort of get into yield territory when you start talking about that stuff. But
I do think it will need to be a product. I think the majority of the world at some point, someone probably, I know Bitcoiners won't like this, but will be looking after their Bitcoin for them. I last night recovered my sister-in-law's cold storage device, something I gave her 18 months ago, because she forgot the PIN number. And that was the first time I've had to do that. And I was saying at that time, I thought, this is just not for everyone. And so there's certainly going to be models out there that will have custodial services that, yeah, businesses can rely on. Because, yeah, you're right, you can't expect everybody, as much as we'd love to see it, deep dive into that rabbit hole where we've been for the last few years.
Well, I think that's why it's a funny kind of reversal, but, you know, the whole idea of Bitcoin is to remove these financial intermediaries, but in a way it's like your Binances of the world are really the ones that are the biggest issue here in terms of the rug effect.
Yes.
Like, deep down, I think, again, like a local Kiwi-owned cooperative bank with a business product for helping people get Bitcoin exposure, I feel a lot more trustworthy. And you just look at the monkeys that are running Binance New Zealand and you think, fuck, I wouldn't trust these guys with, you know, changing the light bulb in the room, let alone Bitcoin, you know? And I wonder, how does that manifest? Because if that was available, kind of an invest now type setup, or even it's a service within the bank, you know, you log into your online banking and it's just there, you know, click and go. You know, would that mean we suddenly get all this exposure within New Zealand? And then does that lead towards broader adoption and, I guess, getting towards 150,000 Bitcoins?
Yeah, yes, you know? Yes. Yeah, the magic number.
I don't know. I just...
I mean, it would certainly help contribute to growing that. I mean, you could also... I mean, we've got lawyers at the moment who look after families' assets and trusts and the like. I could see it being similar to that, where you can purchase it and you actually just, lawyers, I mean, it's well outside of my area of specialty, but basically administer it on behalf of the clients.
Yeah, because I think the call to action, I guess, is what I'm looking at it from a branding perspective, but the call to action at the moment, like, I've got a phone call I need to do on the weekend with someone and kind of helping them get their Bitcoin off an exchange, and I'm feeling a bit of trepidation because I think, fuck, what do I know? I'm going to have to do some research on sort of what I recommend, because, you know, when it's your own Bitcoin, it's a different story. But when it's a friend or family member, it's like, well, shit, I can't be responsible for the outcome, but I can try my best to give you the leading edge of best practice.
And they're putting their full trust in you to provide that solution for them.
So it's sort of a bit challenging, but I mean, that's me as an amateur, basically. But, you know, if you had, you know, these kind of institutions able to offer that, and, you know, they had systems in place, I think that's, you know, I mean, there's legislation, there's things that kind of bind them to that, and it's a little bit more, I mean, I don't know if you call it more trustworthy, but certainly it's easier to engage with without, you know, doing all of this, you know, deep dive.
Yeah, so for a lot of people, it'll have a sense of familiarity about it too, so they actually feel more comfortable when you sort of start talking to someone about your Bitcoin, and then they're like, well, where do you keep it? And you show them the cold storage, and they just suddenly just run a mile, think, what is all this? What do you mean if it's lost, it's lost forever? Well, where's the help desk? Yeah. Can't you just ring up and reset? No. It's good fun.
Yeah, I mean, imagine that, you know, log into your ANZ and you go to the drop down and opening your account, and it's opening your Bitcoin account, you know, and it's right there. And then making sure that exists within a space that is able to still send and receive without limitation, you know, because I think that's where the adversarial Bitcoiner in me comes out and says, well, shit, it's just going to be blue Bitcoin that's, you know, locked in and it's traced and all of that. But still, I can see a situation. I know certainly a large number of people who would click that button. I guess, though, it comes back to the risk profile, because when it's going up and when it's going down, it's sort of perhaps one of the reasons, you know, banks don't offer a lot of these other financial services. And maybe there's legislation related to it, but, you know, it becomes more casino-esque when, you know, it's more like what was that that app? Sharesies.
Yes.
You know, that's very casino-esque kind of, you know, buying and selling kind of Robin Hood style. I feel like the banks maybe don't want to have a bar of that, perhaps. I don't know.
They've probably at the moment got constitutions and the like that at the moment it just would be a case of we're curious, we're keeping a watchful eye, but just not now.
Well, maybe, I mean, look, if there's anyone out there who's interested in chatting about it, I mean, I think it's almost like an open letter or something, you know, and maybe I'll have a look into that Institute of Accountants that you mentioned, New Zealand and Australia, and just see, have they put anything out there? Because I think at the very least, getting awareness, you know, what does the average accountant know about this when their client's coming to them and saying, hey, I want some Bitcoin? Are they telling them to pull their head in, or are they actually recommending resources? Like, there's all of these kind of ways that people will come to it. And if it's a 1% allocation of that cash you've got sitting around in the bank account, just for a little bit, I mean, that's certainly a step towards the world that we are looking for. And I think it can have a powerful impact on this, you know, the position of your business if you hold that over, say, a 4-year term. When, you know, a lot of businesses, you know, are struggling just day to day, maybe they can't think that far ahead. I don't know.
When you raised a good question earlier, I was just thinking last night, you know, when I bought that, yeah, it's a big reminder saying this must come from a personal account. I actually couldn't even inform a business how to successfully buy Bitcoin as a business. You could as the business owner in their personal name, but yeah, I wouldn't actually know.
And I think straight away, what you know, that would be maybe okay for your mum and pop,
yes.
Self-employed,
sole trader, but any kind of company with a board of directors would just, you know, turn it straight away. That'd be red flags if you got a director buying stuff in their own name and selling it to the business.
it just
wouldn't work.
It's probably a bit embarrassing. I actually don't know how it would be done. I just wouldn't know where to buy it from.
Because, I mean, maybe that's the hole here that we're talking about, because, I mean, again, there's businesses sitting on this cash. Cash is king in this tough environment, but at the same time, you know, they're losing purchasing power. And there's a real opportunity with some of these good news stories coming out that if you just hold a little bit.
Yeah, we're certainly not saying allocate at all. But, you know, if you're willing to hold a little bit, you'll probably find over time you want to allocate a little bit more as well. A question I often get asked, or a common question I get asked when I've been talking to people about it, I sort of this the other week, is can you sell it? So I actually think a lot of people don't feel it's that liquid.
Yeah, I think I tend to agree with that. I think, you know, selling to fiat is actually a real challenge. You know, there are a lot of compliance, especially if it's a large number, you know, and tax implications. And I wonder, yeah, I mean, how would you dissolve, how would you liquidate, you know, a large amount of Bitcoin in New Zealand? I mean, you could sell it through an exchange.
That would be
the default way.
Yes, yeah.
Is it a private sale? You know, does the bank ask you where did this money come from? It's just hit your bank account.
Well, they certainly could. I mean, you sort of had $300,000 or something just flow in for a small business.
Which, I mean, maybe, I don't know, what's their compliance look like with that? How much due diligence do the banks need to do to make sure that you've told them everything you need to tell them?
I think,
you know, it's
quite extensive, the compliance that the banks need to undertake in order to, you know, you see things on X around people getting asked, you know, when they're just trying to deposit $2,000 cash into their bank account, well, what's this for? Or if you want to take $2,000 cash out, what's it for? What are you doing with it?
Well, is that where we're making a bit of a mistake in judgment, though? Because we're talking about cash here, and cash is this leading edge.
I think it's any movement of funds in and out of an account.
Oh, but still, it's the leading edge of, you know, say an institution's financial position. You know, there's a cash component, but I'm sure a huge part of it's going to be stuff like other assets, you know, real estate,
yes,
you know, stock holdings. And a lot of those things will never get liquidated. They just exist on the balance sheet. And so I wonder, you know, the idea of selling a house and getting the cash in the bank account, you know, that happens once every, you know, X many years, but the actual house, the value of that house still continues to exist on someone's balance sheet. And I wonder if instead of selling it, we see a situation where it's sort of the Bitcoin moves around on the Bitcoin layer, but it isn't compensated for with cash. You know, I wonder if there's other ways of that being transported, you know, because I think it's very messy to dip into the cash world and have that money hit the bank account. Like, I don't know, what do you think?
Well, ideally, when we've got the circular economy, it won't be getting liquidated into cash. It'll be used to directly purchase whatever it is that it's been liquidated for cash for.
That's what I'm thinking. Like, you know, in terms of assets, like, it seems, you know, like a large amount of Bitcoin isn't, you know, like, because realistically, what are you going to do with hundreds of thousands of dollars of cash sitting there? You know, you're not able to spend, you're not able to withdraw it into physical cash. There's reporting limits on trying to spend that on buying stuff.
Ideally, you'd go straight to the truck manufacturer and purchase that truck to directly with their Bitcoin.
And I wonder if that's sort of the position we see. And maybe there's a bifurcation of kind of scales where, you know, maybe a small amount of Bitcoin can get sold. You know, it's kind of, you know, lightning. It's kind of dipping in and out of fiat. But actually, you know, purchasing, you know, real estate or investing in a business, for example, you know, I want to invest in your company. I'm going to buy the shares using Bitcoin directly. You know, there's no intermediary in terms of fiat cash. And I wonder if that's for larger purchases, I mean, for anything over a certain amount, that's kind of more the de facto. Because I had a conversation with a guy, and he you know, had a property in Argentina, a vineyard that he was trying to liquidate, and he was saying, man, it was fucking impossible to get that money into New Zealand. And I mentioned Bitcoin, but he was like, oh, but then how do I get the Bitcoin into New Zealand dollars? And I think he didn't quite understand it. I was saying, well, no, you don't do that.
You don't need to be doing that.
You don't need to be doing that. And you know, he's talking millions of dollars here. And I mean, I'm in no position to provide financial advice, but I said, well, look, you know, trying to get US dollars out of somewhere like Argentina, yeah, probably the Bitcoin is the easiest way to do it. But it's kind of sticky in the sense that once you're in the Bitcoin, you don't really want to get out. But it's almost like you're shooting yourself in the foot trying to liquidate that. I don't know. Sort of, that's my take on it.
Yeah, no, cash out of Argentina at the moment, US dollars into New Zealand dollars, it'd be quite the...
They ask a lot of questions.
Yes, yeah. And the costs of doing that would be, I imagine, enormous.
Yeah, so I wonder if we start seeing this emerging, almost sort of like a... I mean, it is an asset class, but we sort of see this emerging role of, you know, reasonable sized Bitcoin holdings acting as a kind of different way of, I guess, engaging with assets and liabilities, you know. So instead of dipping into the cash, into the kitty and the New Zealand dollars, you've got it on your balance sheet. Your business is in a solid position. It is liquid if you need it to be, in the sense that like shares are liquid as well.
Yes. But
it's not, you know, it's not dollars as such. It's dollar denominated. And with these new accounting rules, the FASB rules, right?
Yes.
Maybe it sits on the bank account as this kind of other thing, a bit like, say, having some real estate holdings or some shares on a business's bank and balance sheet that they can then move around. And if they want to acquire half of your business, they just purchase it with Bitcoin, and that Bitcoin moves from their balance sheet to your balance sheet. It never interfaces with New Zealand dollars. It simply is denominated in New Zealand dollars. And that kind of goes around a lot of these issues.
You're describing the vision we all want to see. I mean, I think, you know, in our lifetimes, we will see that. It's going to be exciting.
Yeah. Well, look, Dan, I appreciate it. We've gone into a few different places. I appreciate this new territory for you, though, talking about the stuff on the show. But I know we've talked a lot about this sort of just in person at BitKiwi events and that sort of thing. But certainly food for thought.
Yeah, no, thank you, Cody. It's been a lot of fun.
That's good. And you'll be back in New Zealand for...
Early February, yeah.
For Queenstown?
Yep, a couple of weeks for Queenstown, and certainly looking forward to that. Planning's well advanced. There's actually quite a lot of excitement about Queenstown. When we first talked about Queenstown, I think, oh, it's a beautiful destination, but it's also quite an expensive one with a reasonably limited population. I wonder how many will make it there, and to our surprise, this is basically everyone we know is going. It's great.
But hey, man, I think it's going to be good. I think 2024 is going to be great.
I'm excited.
It's only a couple of days in, but we're still, stuff's picking up. And yeah, all the best with BitKiwi stuff. I really appreciate the work you guys are doing. And I think it's we're going to look back on the good old days when it was just a bunch of us hanging around at the Fork and Brewer in Wellington talking about Bitcoin, lamenting, you know, the hyper-Bitcoinization that has just happened.
Well, absolutely. Well, I had a call with BitKiwi Paul last night, and we were reminiscing about it, and it's only been a couple of years, you think, and think how far we've come.
Yeah.
We, the community, I mean. It's pretty special.
That's great stuff. All right, man, thank you very much.
Thank you, Cody.
Thank you for listening. I do hope you enjoyed the show. I am Cody Allingham, and that was the Transformation of Value. If you would like to get in touch, please send me an email at hello@thetransformationofvalue.com, and I will get back to you.